Well, do you, Bunk?
This April at the Rio, Open Mic Nights will now be happening twice monthly. A showcase of local musicians, comedians, poets, and variety acts. Doors at 7 p.m. and the show starts at 8 for these free 19-plus events, April 4th and 18th. Want more live entertainment? Check out Dirty Dancing Burlesque at the Rio April 5th, a burlesque show featuring live music with all the hit songs from the Dirty Dancing soundtrack and burlesque inspired by the movie. Saturday, April 7th. Back by popular demand, it's the Big Screen Barrel House 2, a modern throwback to the silent film era. Film classics will have their soundtracks reimagined by some of Vancouver's most talented acts. Wednesday, April 11th, it's Canada's own classical pianist and DJing wonder kid, Chili Gonzalez. Get your advance tickets through the Rio website today or at Red Cat, High Life, and Zulu Records. Wondering what to do on 420? For only a toonie, come out to the Champion of Champions variety show. The audience will determine a first place $500 and a second place $150 winner and will get the chance to win some swell swag for themselves. For more information on all this and more, check out theriotheatre.ca.
I'm gonna be round my vegetables. I'm gonna chow down my vegetables. I love you most of all, my favorite vegetable.
Sprouts. It's your 75-cent coffee fix and sub.
It's your source for reasonably priced, creatively named stew and vegan brownies.
It's your purveyor of bicycle-delivered local produce.
It's also a place where volunteers can realize their vision of responsible business and where like-minded students can explore UBC's food systems.
Hark! Sprouts is currently accepting applications for next year's executive board and is encouraging ambitious, creative, and disciplined students from all faculties and year levels to apply.
Come by Sprouts in the sub-basement to learn more about our projects and how to get involved.
I tried to kick the ball, but my tinny flew right off. I'm red as a beet, 'cause I'm so embarrassed.
Right here on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taking to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
Good evening. It is 5:08 and time for another full hour of independent news. Our headlines will cover news from the UBC campus, local news from Metro Vancouver, provincial and federal news from across Canada, as well as news from around the world. We will also be chatting with Jesse Lemieux from Pacific Permaculture about exactly what that is and an upcoming project sharing event.
All this plus your weekend weather forecast right here on News 101, your source for independent news. And now for your UBC campus news and local headlines.
UBC has added new security measures to the Museum of Anthropology to protect valuable additions to the museum's world-renowned collection. Works by famed Haida artist Bill Reed were donated to the Museum of Anthropology in early March, including gold and silver brooches valued at over $500,000. The museum also recently acquired a Nuchalnu ceremonial club valued at $1.2 million, which was presented to Captain James Cook in 1777. Acting Director of UBC Security Paul Wong said the investments were both in technology and resources for security workers. In email to the UBC newspaper, Wong said, quote, the university invested in additional electronic and security personnel resources following the Bill Reid theft, end quote. Wong was referring to the theft that took place in 2008 at the Museum of Anthropology, where 12 of Bill Reid's works were stolen. Although all the pieces were later recovered, a carved pipe was damaged, as were the pieces of Mexican jewelry from Oaxaca.
Although UBC plans its academic calendar 5 years in advance, most UBC students will be surprised to hear that for the next academic year, Term 2 classes will start on January 2nd, 2013. This means that students won't really be able to enjoy New Year's Day, since many of them, especially those living outside Canada, will have to pack their bags on the 1st and get back to school. To explain the surprise, Christopher Eaton, Associate Registrar for UBC Enrollment Services, said, quote, I admit that January 2nd is a bit harsh of a start, but we have a goal to get as many teaching days as possible and to have at least 60 instructional days. One thing we find very important is to have the classes so we can end exams so those in off-campus housing or even residence will be able to vacate from May 1st so they don't have to pay extra, end quote. Eaton was referring to the fact that if Term 2 of the 2012-2013 year started Monday, January 7th instead, the final day for exams would be April 30th, potentially leaving some students scrambling between studying for their last exam and packing up to get out of residence. He also pointed out that the chance of moving the term start date is very unlikely. And it might seem residence advisors for our student residents have it even harder, since the new date requires that they arrive back in residence at 5 p.m. on December 31st. That's brutal. Meaning those advisors who are international students will have to celebrate New Year's Eve away from family.
Don't want to be an advisor next year.
I know, that was so sad.
First-year students entering the University of British Columbia's Vancouver campus this fall can expect a more personal touch. All new undergraduate students at UBC Vancouver will be assigned to an enrollment services professional who can answer questions and help students resolve problems involving financial planning, eligibility for bursaries and scholarships, and a host of other services. UBC is in the process of hiring 23 ESPs who will be assigned to students in June as they register for fall classes. Each ESP will eventually oversee about 300 students for the duration of their undergraduate careers. UBC expects to hire some 65 ESPs by June 2013, as the program is rolled out to include all undergraduate students at UBC Vancouver. The program, dubbed Names, Not Numbers, aims to establish a stronger relationship between the university and its students. The program is part of a broader UBC initiative aimed at enhancing student engagement. The changes include a shift to broad-based admissions at the university announced earlier this year and a proposal to introduce a learning plan for all first-year students. Speaking of broad-based admissions, according to Lisa Collins, Associate Registrar and Project Director for the new enrollment services model, UBC saw a drop of 12% in the number of applications it received this year from last. Collins says it was most likely because new application is more involved and takes longer to complete. She also pointed out that other institutions have moved to broad-based admissions, having experienced similar declines. UBC receives about 300,000 applications to undergraduate programs a year, and last year enrolled 5,900 new first-year students.
And with no sign of an agreement in sight between UBC negotiators and the Teaching Assistance Union, CUPE 2278, last week UBC applied for a mediator to join the collective bargaining discussion with the TA's union. A bulletin posted by UBC on Wednesday afternoon stated that the first mediations will start May 10th, eliminating the risk of a strike during exams. The bulletin said, quote, the collective bargaining process does not allow for strikes during mediation. Therefore, UBC does not expect to see any strike activity during exams, end quote. The BC Labor Relations Board has agreed to appoint Mark Atkinson as mediator between the two parties, who will join the discussion to help lead both sides to an agreement. When mediations begin, both UBC and CUP 2278 must stay at the table until either an agreement is reached or the mediator voluntarily or by request withdraws. A 48-hour period must pass after the mediations dissolve before a strike or lockout can occur. UBC Public Affairs Director Lucy McNeil said that the union's monetary requests, which include paid leave, benefits for childcare, and a fully paid transit pass, would add an extra $23 million to the already $18 million payroll, an increase of 130%. However, UBC is still bound by the net zero mandate of the provincial government, which restricts any wage increases. CUP2278 made a comment on their blog on April 6th that they will be seeking legal advice on the implications of a mediator entering the discussion, but are still refusing interviews and haven't commented since.
In more news from the second of three UBC unions threatening to strike, COPE38, the union representing the AMS and its security staff, is waiting to hear from the Labor Relations Board on whether or not there will be a strike. But the answer might not come until the end of exams. The mediator in the dispute has decided that the two sides should be allowed to start a work stoppage, and while they could have imposed a contract, the AMS and COPE said, 38, said the mediator... 378 said the mediator found their proposals were too far apart. COPE378 supported the mediator's decision, pointing out that they were not happy that there had not been progress on wages. The AMS, however, has appealed, asking for mediated talks to continue or for an arbitrator to close a deal. The Labor Relations Board has 20 days to make a decision on the AMS's appeal. The union is proposing a wage increase from $11.50 per hour to $16 for this year, and then $21.13 per hour for guards next year. The AMS is proposing a sliding scale from $11.50 an hour to $13 an hour for current employees, with a reduction to $10.50 an hour for new employees. The union is also asking for a number of benefits, including more paid sick leave, medical benefits for those working over 24 hours a week, and an extra $3 per hour in lieu of benefits for part-time staff. AMS President Matt Parsons said that, quote, it would be fairly difficult to burden that increase without fairly drastic reduction of services elsewhere in the AMS, end quote. He also said the AMS has calculated that the increase would be 70% or more than $161,000 over the current contract.
And those were your UBC campus and local headlines on News 101. We're going to take a quick break, but please do stay tuned for your provincial and national news as well as your local weather forecast. I'm Claire Eagle, and you're listening to CITR News 101.
Want to know what's up at UBC? Read the UBC. It's only the largest student newspaper in Western Canada, and it's written and edited entirely by UBC students. The UBC is your source for on-campus news, culture, and sports. New editions come out every Monday and Thursday. For breaking news as well as amazing videos and blogs, check out ubc.ca.
AMS Food Bank. Your access to money during the studies at UBC will most likely be limited, but it is a priority of the AMS Food Bank to ensure your access to food is not. The AMS Food Bank provides emergency food relief 7 days a week for all UBC students. To volunteer with the food bank or for inquiries about how to take advantage of the services provided, contact them at foodbank@ams.ubc.ca. For more information, find the AMS Food Bank on Facebook or feel free to visit anytime across from the Wellness Center and Sprouts.
This April, Chamber Concerts and CITR Radio are proud to present. First up, it's Acid Mother's Temple, with special guest, the Phantom Family Halo. This Japanese soul collective will hit the Media Club Wednesday, April 18th. Advance tickets available online at northerntickets.com, the Northern Tickets box office on Granville Street, and at Red Cat and Zulu Records. Next up, it's Caveman from Brooklyn. This indie rock band is on tour to support their debut release, Coco Beware, performing with special guests, the Albertans from, you guessed it, Alberta. This is an early show Friday, April 20th at the Biltmore Cabaret. Advance tickets available online at northerntickets.com, the Northern Tickets box office, or at Red Cat and Zulu Records. For more information, please visit chamberconcerts.com.
Welcome back, and now we have your weekend weather forecast with Phil from the Storm Club.
Hi, Phil.
Hey, good afternoon, and thank you. Good evening, listeners. No chance of precipitation this weekend, as a high-pressure ridge lingers over the North American west coast. Similar to our southern neighbors, we'll have a very stable atmosphere, meaning little active weather apart from light winds until the next front arrives on Monday. More about that later. Back to this weekend. In theory, we'll see a fair amount of sunlight, but the models are predicting scattered clouds on three different categories of cloud height. So in practice, we could see anything ranging from scattered clouds to full overcast skies during the next 72 hours. Meanwhile, temperatures continue to hold steadily around 10 degrees. Now, in the long-term forecast, the front I mentioned is expected to arrive around Monday morning. Judging from its appearance, this one holds quite a lot of moisture, so I'll strongly suggest bringing an umbrella with you that day when heading out. Now, here's your three-day weekend weather forecast for UBC. Tonight, cloudy, low of 5. Saturday, scattered clouds, high of 12, low of 8. Sunday, partly cloudy in the morning and overcast at night, high of 12, low of 8. So that's your weekend weather forecast for UBC, brought to you by the UBC Storm Club. Currently, it is around 9 degrees on UBC campus. Reporting for News 101, I'm Phil Chang.
And thanks as always for that, Phil. It's always a pleasure to have you on and hear our weekend weather forecast. So it's now time for your provincial and national news.
The BC Supreme Court has ruled a section of Canada's medical marijuana laws, which states that licensed users cannot possess pot, cookies, or marijuana creams, is unconstitutional. Justice Robert Johnson struck down the section today by following a case involving Owen Smith, who was charged with trafficking for baking pot cookies and producing creams for a medical marijuana club in Victoria back in 2009. Although Justice Johnston ruled in favor of a charge to the marijuana laws, he said that Smith will still have to stand trial for trafficking because he may have been selling his products to individuals who are not legally permitted to use.
On a somewhat related illicit substance note, the BC provincial government has approved a change to liquor laws which will allow theaters to serve alcohol during showings. In a government release, it was announced that although liquor could be served during showings, it had to be adults only, quote, no alcohol is permitted when a movie is shown or broadcast is aired when minors are present, end quote. Minister of Energy and Mines, Rich Coleman, said in a statement, quote, these changes give movie theaters and live event theaters much more flexibility to operate while allowing adults to responsibly enjoy a drink while watching a movie, end quote. This change comes after a widely publicized fight to liberalize liquor laws by the owners of Vancouver's historic Rio Theatre. Leah Corrine, the owner of the Rio, said, quote, we are absolutely thrilled. These are the changes we've been fighting for. Basically, this means we can get back to running our theatre in a productive way and should hopefully improve our financial situation dramatically, end quote. Many people involved in the theatre industry feel this will be a much-needed profit booster at a time when more and more people have access to in-home movies. Corrine said being allowed to serve liquor, quote, adds to the experience of people enjoying the show. It makes sense and it's something that people have wanted for a long time, end quote. Prior to this ruling, the Silver City in Coquitlam served liquor on premises but outside of screening rooms because of food services in the building, which operated on restaurant-type licenses.
Well, that should be fun, Claire.
I think it should.
In other news, a BC Emergency Communications Center is urging people to be more careful with cell phones after thousands of accidental 911 calls tied up phone lines last year in Metro Vancouver. Based on a recent analysis of call statistics by ECOM, an emergency center responsible for dispatching services to police and fire departments, there were more than 110,000 accidental calls recorded in 2011, Watch your phones, people. And of that, 70,000 were pocket dials and 40,000 were abandoned calls or hangups. Corey Kelso, an Ecom 911 call taker, said that, quote, "I've had a lot of calls from Rogers Arena when the Canucks were playing. I've heard pucks drop, I've heard the announcements, and I've actually heard Richard Loney singing the national anthem," end quote. The amount of pocket dials from cell phones has also jumped by 10% in 4 years, with over 200 pocket calls per day. The emergency center is urging the public to use key locks, store cell phones in protective cases, and not pre-program 911.
The Supreme Court of Canada has struck down a law that allowed police to immediately start wiretaps in urgent cases without getting a search warrant. The 9-0 ruling stripped police of an investigative power and gave Parliament 12 months to rewrite the law to fix a breach under the Charter of Rights and Freedoms. The Friday ruling stemmed from an unusual case that reached the High Court after the conviction of six men in a brutal kidnapping case in Richmond, B.C. A British Columbia Supreme Court judge sentenced the men to prison terms ranging from 10 to 18 years in the February 2006 abduction of Peter Lee, his wife Jennifer Pan, and their friend Chow Chang. The RCMP started wiretapping immediately after they learned of the kidnapping and only obtained the necessary judicial authorization 24 hours later. At trial, the judge ruled the police violated the Charter of Rights, but admitted the wiretap evidence anyway. Such cases usually get to Ottawa only after a provincial appeal court hearing, but BC prosecutors sought and were granted leave to take the matter directly to the Supreme Court. So we're going to take a quick break, but stay tuned for your international news.
The alphabet has only 26 letters. With these 26 magic symbols, however, millions of words are written every day.
April and Discorder is here. Daffodils are blooming, cherry blossoms blossoming, and Discorder smells spring fresh off the presses. Check inside for monthly faves, The Overeducated Grumbler, on the topic of Dan Levy, getting textually active with rock stars, and news on the venues you know and love. Read up on the lovelies of Ruffled Feathers, Indigo Kids, and Dirty Spells, and figure out where to pick up hard copies of their stuff at your favorite local record store on Record Store Day. Reviews, calendars, charts, interviews, art projects, photos, write-ups, and teardowns, all that and more in your free April issue of Discorder. Pick up your beautiful and free copy of Discorder at any Friends of CITR business, or if you've gone paperless, don't forget to check out Discorder at discorder.ca. Discorder, that magazine from CITR, supporting local music for over 25 years.
Well, the hardcore stuff is just is fast, very aggressive and loud, you know, music, angry music.
I am your host, Mr. Steeston Mike. Welcome to the Flex Your Head Show on CITR 101.9 FM here in Vancouver. I'm here every Tuesday.
6 to 8 p.m.
Playing some punk and hardcore for you. If you want to hear something, feel free to give me a call at 604-822-2487 or swing by flexyourhead.net and send us an email with a request.
Welcome back to CITR News 101, and now we're going to just kind of take a piece of news and rummage it around.
By that she means this is an editorial section, I guess.
Yeah. And so basically, as you heard earlier, we announced about the changes in the first day of second semester, which will now be on...
Well, technically, it's not a change. According to the office, they've planned their calendars five years in advance.
Yeah, I guess it's catching people's attention now, because obviously this is...
Nobody pays attention to calendars.
No one's looking 5 years ahead, so now people are starting to notice it, and all of a sudden students are thinking, like, gosh, this is terrible, especially for international students who often spend over 24 hours traveling. For many of them, they're going to have terrible New Year's. And I think for people where culturally New Year's is important, I think that's quite tough.
Yeah, and it's not just... I mean, New Year's happens everywhere. It's a totally new calendar. It's not like Christmas celebrated by some. But what I don't understand is
why the advisors had to come on the 31st at night, because what are they going to accomplish on New Year's Eve at the university?
They always have the advisors in two nights beforehand, just to sort of prepare, I think.
Yeah, but they have a set, like, training session or something like that.
But it definitely is. I wonder if it will be a deterrent for any people entering into Res Life. I know those contracts, a lot of them have already been sent out, but I wonder if that's something that will influence people's decisions.
And I just have a question. Is that only going to be this year?
Yes, 2013. The last time this happened was 2001, and the next time it'll happen is 2018. But that's only because this, the way the calendar has worked out.
What I'm interested in, because I think, CJ, I mean, it seems like you know your a lot of your dates on this, and it seems like...
I read.
It's excellent. I mean, they said that they wanted to shift it forward so as not to have exams extend too long and move out, like, to reach out past, like, move-out day.
They kind of have a valid point.
But I'm wondering, I mean, this year, semester started on, what, the 5th, and exams are finished by the 26th. So, like, where's that discrepancy coming from? Do we know?
No, I don't. But their point is that if school starts on the 7th, in 2013, Jan 7th, and their last day of exams will have to be technically April 30th.
So right? Why can't they start it on the 3rd and end on the 27th?
That's one of the things that people are not... I read an editorial in the UBC newspaper as well where why can't we just push it to the 4th or the 3rd?
Yeah, exactly.
Is the 2nd a Monday?
Oh, I can
Do they always have to start on a Monday?
I'll find that out for you.
It's a Wednesday. That's a tricky part too. If you have to start school midweek, then you can't really start on a Thursday, which is the 3rd.
Yeah.
And you can't start on Friday, which is the 4th.
Oh.
So you either start on a 7th, which is a Monday, or a 2nd, which is a Wednesday.
Or on the 2nd, I guess so, yeah.
It's just the way the year has panned out.
Has had to play out.
January has panned out. Yeah.
But, I mean, I think that's one of those things. I think if they pushed it back a day, even to the 3rd, I mean... Yeah, maybe starting on a Thursday might not make the most sense, but then at the same time, our last day of class is also on a Thursday. I mean, I think it's one of those things that people, they accommodate, you know? I don't think anyone would be up in arms.
On the other hand, the other thing is they would have had to compress the exam time. I don't know how many exams they organize. It must be hundreds.
Yeah,
right?
That's definitely
and
difficult.
Thousands of students. So if you have to compress it...
What I'm thinking right now is... if a lot of people are just going to not show up to the first day of classes, because I mean, I think that's the most,
probably.
I mean, if you're an international student and why would you skip New Year's just to come to the very first class if you don't even think that's interesting? So
get
it'd
your
be,
syllabus and stuff.
Yeah. You'd be hungover as hell on New Year's Day.
Yeah.
And then you just wouldn't want to get on a 24-hour plane ride.
Yeah, exactly. No, it's
immigration would just look at you like, dude, why are you doing this?
Well, I think even just like sort of from a logistical perspective, I mean, if
it's
class starts on the 2nd, it's going to be expensive, it's going to be difficult. I mean, that's going to be tough for those students who have to do that. It's good people are realizing it now because they can start planning already.
Yeah.
But it'll be interesting for sure. It's funny how little things like this get students so... up in arms.
Yeah.
You know?
and then, I don't know if anybody got the tuition increase email last night, that tuition will be increasing next year again. It doesn't say in the email.
2%. I've actually read a really good editorial in the UBC about this, where, I can't explain it, it's really complicated, but the fact of the matter is that in the 90s, the Liberal government had this tuition freeze that they had put up, and then the NDP government, after them, lifted the freeze, after they lifted it, there was a law that stated that they could only increase it by 2%.
Right. Okay.
Even though they needed to increase it by much
more, but they couldn't.
Why do they need to increase by much more?
To keep up with inflation.
Inflation's at 3.5.
UBC has to raise $25 million every year to keep up with inflation. And the only way they can do that is tuition.
What I'm wondering is, with the whole strike that's happening in Quebec, how are they keeping up with inflation? If it takes UBC...
I think that's what a lot of the protests are about right now, is that they're trying to sort of solve that discrepancy. But I think there's more government funding in Quebec.
Yes, much more.
There's a lot more, and that's why it's so much cheaper there.
Yeah.
But obviously, like, even they're feeling that pinch because they're trying to raise tuition by, $300 every year or something like that, just to try and get some more of that funding, because obviously government cutbacks are they're everywhere and they do need to be getting more funding. So, I mean, I think tuition increases is something like we see across the board, but I mean, we definitely were not paying the full amount for tuition, or for inflation rather, which is nice, I guess. I mean, it's
nice in a weird way, because inflation is also caused by expectancies. So we're going to be paying more, and because of that, inflation is going to increase again, and it's an endless cycle.
Yeah, it just keeps going. Yeah, I mean, as something I know personally from the Sauder School of Business, that we've student fees.
Watch out, everyone.
The student fees for the School of Business are going to be, I think, $750 next year. Or 777, something like that.
That's per student per term?
Per student for the
increase.
Year. That's how much it's going up from 270 right now.
Wow.
Because we have a $500 building fee that's coming in that was voted on in a referendum 2 years ago and it's being introduced now.
Did they not find hella money that they could use?
There's a lot of money
in Sauder,
but
grants
I guess
from
we need more, I guess, to pay for that beautiful building.
To pay for
there.
That hot chocolate room that I still would love to see.
$11 per student for a year for all the coffee you can drink.
Yeah, go Sauder.
But I guess just bringing it back to the dates, the calendar change, it seemed interesting that I guess the people who made the calendar, they seem quite set that they're not really going to change their policy on this, right? I mean, they said it's unlikely to see change.
What doesn't make sense is that what if people don't come to that class? It's more for saying that, well, there were their spending classes, but who knows how many people are really going to show up to their first class now.
I guess it's the university's responsibility to make sure the class is available if students want to go.
So are they saying 60 because they pay professors 60 instructional days? Do they pay professors per term or per course?
I believe it's per course.
Okay.
That's something we should look into. That we should try. We can do some follow up work for News 101.
Yeah, bring in a couple professors.
Yeah, I wonder what professors' views on this are, because I think we've heard a lot of the student blowback of it. But that being said, I mean, professors obviously they need their time off as well. A lot of them are conducting research. They're marking, I mean, they're traveling.
A lot of them travel,
Yeah, families too, yeah.
Yeah, exactly, and I think those experiences are often what makes professors, like the really great professors, stand out, is that they have a lot of this travel experience or research experience doing new things, so I wonder how they're seeing that impact, and if they're anywhere near as upset as all these students are.
All these spoiled university students.
It's true.
I think they're fine, because according to another report that I read, UBC's professors...
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and Canadian professors are among the highest paid in the world.
Wow.
Even higher than American ones.
No way.
Yeah.
Which is...
That's very
sure
interesting.
American professors apparently, at the height of their career, get paid at a maximum average of $88,000.
Okay.
And Canadian professors get a maximum average of $114,000 a year.
Wow. That is
at the height
big.
Of their career. And so that's quite an interesting statistic. But I'm sure professors some of them might be grumpy about this Jan 2nd thing.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see for sure. But I guess these are the changes that happen every year, and we'll just have to see what happens from there. So
yeah, well, we are going to take a quick break.
But stay with us for an interview with...
Jesse Lemieux from Permaculture Pacific Permaculture.
Listen, if they're so hot, how come they're not tearing up the charts, babe?
Because you never play them, babe.
At CITR, our hosts choose the music they play. That means our charts actually reflect the tastes of music lovers, as opposed to focus groups. So if you want to know what's really tearing up the charts, get your hands on a copy of Beatroot or Discorder magazine, or go online to CITR.ca. CITR's charts are based on actual spins motivated by actual preference. No payola, no marketing, just good tunes. Refreshing, no?
Thank you.
Hello, hello, hello. My name is Tim, and every Thursday from 1 to 2 p.m. I will be playing best punk, hardcore, metal, ska, and reggae music for you from all over the world. We all fall down on 101.9 FM CITR in Vancouver, British Columbia.
How much do you know about bikes? Everything? Perfect. Nothing at all? Even better. At the UBC Bike Kitchen, you can use our space and tools to do your own bike maintenance, get one-on-one instruction on how to fix your bike yourself, or drop your bike off for us to repair. You can also buy a fully refurbished, guaranteed used bicycle, or a variety of new and used parts and accessories. The Bike Kitchen is UBC's non-profit, student-owned, full-service bike shop. We're located in the basement of the Student Union building. Just look for the stairwell on the north side of the sub across from Gage Towers, or search for the UBC Bike Kitchen on Facebook. Stop by the Bike Kitchen and then get riding.
Winnie Cooper is proud to present the Thursday Concert Series at 560 Club. With one of the biggest video walls in North America, 560 is quickly becoming one of the nicest venues Vancouver has to offer. 560 also features four floors, each presenting you with a different musical vibe. In the coming months, the Thursday Concert Series will be presenting you with some of the hottest musical acts to hit town. Get your tickets quick for Lil B, performing the WinnieCooper.net four-year anniversary party at 560. Advanced tickets are available through WinnieCooper.net, Club Zone, or at Zulu, Beat Street, and Red Cat Records. This will be Lil B, the Bass God's first Canadian appearance. Watch out for the Das Races show, set to perform their unique style of Brooklyn-based hip-hop on May 2nd. The Thursday Concert Series at 560 Club, located at 560 Seymour Street in Vancouver, BC, presented by Winnie Cooper.
Welcome back to CITR News 101, broadcasting to you live from the Student Union Building at UBC. It's now time for our international headlines, and for that we go to Free Speech Radio News.
FSRN. Police arrested 23 protesters who locked themselves inside a Chicago mental health clinic last night. FSRN's Lisa Matuska has more.
As of Friday afternoon, 12 people remained in custody and 11 had been released after police cleared an occupation of the Woodlawn Mental Health Clinic on Chicago's south side. The Woodlawn Clinic, located in a largely low-income African-American neighborhood, is one of six public mental health clinics to be closed due to city budget cuts. Thursday afternoon, patients and supporters gathered for what started as a feast and a celebration, but what was actually a planned occupation. Nadana Carter calls herself a consumer of Chicago's mental health system and has been organizing with a local group to protest the closings of the clinics.
And we're going to stay and keep all of these clinics open. And we're going to travel to each clinic to speak. Last week, two clinics closed. The only clinics that service the Hispanic community.
Addressing a group of supporters outside the clinic, she then announced the occupation and quickly joined the group of 23 people who locked themselves inside the clinic. At 1 a.m., police cut the padlocks and arrested the protesters. The Chicago Department of Public Health claims the cuts will not affect people's access to mental health services, but organizers say they want further investigation. They have requested that the City Council hold a hearing to assess the consequences of these closures, but the request has not been granted. The Woodlawn Clinic is slated to close April 30th. Lisa Matuska, FSRN, Chicago.
In a 2-1 vote, a federal appeals court has struck down a ban on political advertising on public television and radio. The judges said political speech is a core protection under the First Amendment and does not pose a threat to the non-commercial nature of the formats. A former PBS board member told Reuters that the decision, quote, moves us further away from what remains of a public square. The state of Texas is expected to respond today to a Justice Department challenge to its controversial new voter ID law. The feds are requesting previous communications between lawmakers to prove their intentions were to exclude minorities. From San Antonio, FSRN's Andrew Oxford reports.
Under Texas's new voter identification law, 600,000 voters could be excluded from upcoming elections, according to a brief filed by the Department of Justice in federal court on Wednesday. The federal government says excluding these voters, most of them from minority groups, is the intent of the law. Now the Justice Department hopes to prove that by forcing state legislators who authored the new rules to disclose their internal communications on the matter. Civil rights groups challenging the voter ID law are supporting the Justice Department's efforts. Luis Veda is lead counsel for the League of United Latin American Citizens.
The same thing we did in redistricting. The federal court may force them to release 400-some-odd emails, and in there it shows all the intents of discrimination in the redistricting process. Well, we know that the same existed in the voter registration process. That is a purging of Latinos and Black Americans.
The state has so far rebuffed calls for greater disclosure, and Attorney General Greg Abbott previously called the Justice Department's legal challenge an intrusion on the state's rights. Andrew Oxford, FSRN, San Antonio.
Neighbors, activists, and elected leaders gathered Thursday afternoon calling for a federal moratorium on foreclosures nationwide. The crowd assembled in the front yard of 57-year-old Detroit resident Willie Delbridge. Advocates vowed to support foreclosure legislation and to stand in unity against uncooperative banking institutions. From Michigan, FSRN's Monica Ross Williams reports.
Carrying red and white signs, advocates gathered in an effort to prevent Willie Delbridge impending eviction from his property. Delbridge questioning why banks receiving taxpayer funded federal bailouts use bullying tactics to remove homeowners from neighborhoods.
Well, you got a weak economy, you got people losing jobs, and you got people that don't have to worry about that. Just invading and stepping on these people's toes and threatening them and pushing them and scaring people away from their properties. And it just don't make sense. It isn't fair.
A bill proposed by U.S. Congressman Hanson Clark would suspend foreclosures nationally for up to 3 years.
Let's not just evict homeowners out of their homes, because that not only hurts their families, it destroys the property values and neighborhoods.
In the first quarter of 2012, Michigan had the seventh highest foreclosure rate in the nation, according to RealtyTrack. Monica Ross Williams, FSRN, Michigan.
Mexican national Paola Ortiz was deported from Canada last September. She fled an abusive partner in 2006, but was denied refugee status by the Canadian government. Today, she returned to Montreal. FSRN's Lillian Bachter traveled to meet Ortiz at the airport.
Paola Ortiz burst into tears as she saw her two young children for the first time in 7 months. They stayed behind in Canada to continue medical care after Ortiz was deported to Mexico. Ortiz feared she would not be able to return to Canada and that her abuser would find her. But the Canadian government eventually granted her permanent resident status. Ortiz tells other refugees facing deportation to stay strong.
Todos juntos, sí se puede.
All of us together, we can do it. One person alone gets treated like trash, and we are not trash. If we all unite and really support each other, this will change.
Rosalind Wong is a member of Solidarity Across Borders, one of the groups supporting Ortiz.
She had a lot of support. She had a lot of visibility in the media. And these are the things that make sure that a terrible decision gets reversed. But for so many people who don't have access to those things, this return to Canada is not a possibility.
Paola Ortiz said she's filled with hope for her future with her children in Canada and plans to return to school. Lillian Bachter, FSRN, Montreal.
And that's headlines for FSRN. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
And thank you, as always, to FSRN for those headlines. More stories and their full newscast can be found at fsrn.org. So we now go to our interview with Jesse Lemieux from Pacific Permaculture. Originally conceived as permanent agriculture, permaculture design is a positive approach to human progress and development that gives full and measured consideration to landscape, climate, water, food, culture, and nature. Permaculture design generates connected and self-maintaining human systems that have all the resilience, function, abundance of a forest, wetland, or a coral reef. So this term was first coined in 1978 by Australians Bill Mollison and David Holmgren. And Jesse Lemieux, who's our guest today, he studied under Mollison and Jeff Lawton, who's the founder of the world's first permaculture research institute. And recently, Jesse had the honor of serving as the interim head instructor at the PRI. So welcome to the show, Jesse.
Thank you.
So I know I gave kind of a brief rundown of what permaculture is right there, but could you, I guess, go a bit more in depth about that, and more specifically, like, what does Pacific permaculture do?
So Pacific permaculture started about 4 years ago, and we started out as primarily an education service and doing a little bit of design consultancy. Since that time, we've taught numerous permaculture design certificate courses, which is the foundational course that was originated by Mollison back in the early 80s. Mm-hmm. And now we still continue to do that work, but we're moving more into design and consultancy for private landholders, larger organizations, either for-profit or non-for-profit, and we're moving towards, throwing our hat in the ring of the kind of the land development realm.
Oh, that's great. I guess so. Permaculture, that it really is kind of a global movement, right? And how does Pacific permaculture fit in with this global movement, having started in Australia? And what is the sort of global response to it?
We kind of fit in, just like we're one of many permaculture businesses or educators or practitioners that exist around the world.
Mm-hmm.
Jeff Lawton is kind of most notable as my instructor for his ability to produce students that are really active after mm-hmm. they take the permaculture design certificate.
Mm-hmm.
So it's myself, Verge Permaculture in Alberta. They operate out of Calgary. There's another pretty famous group called Milkwood Permaculture in Australia, and a bunch of others that I'm missing right now that are functioning in Australia.
Mm-hmm.
To kind of take permaculture, I guess, to the next step, as
yeah.
it were, from where, you know, Olson and Lawton kind of left off,
mm-hmm.
in this kind of like slow rising star instead of a fast shooting one.
I just have a question. I've just been listening in. If people studying permaculture, what is that coming out of? Is that people who are wanting to get into landscaping, that sort of thing,
like architecture
or like, what does it fit into in terms of careers?
Well, that's a good question, because it can, like, there are some people that come to it and say, well, look, I want to do permaculture as a career, which inevitably leads them to be involved in things like agriculture, landscape design, those kinds of things. But we often, pretty significant portion of our students are just professionals. You know, some of them are landscape architects or landscapers. There's engineers often, mm-hmm. biologists, teachers, accountants. I've had film producers take my course, and some people are doing it so they can incorporate these ideas into their personal life, and some people do it so they can, you know, bring these ideas and incorporate them into how they're actually functioning in the business world. It's really, oftentimes, permaculture is just misconstrued as just gardening, and that's not what it is at all, and it's actually in that grab bag that's known as sustainability, which is solar panels and electric cars or hybrid cars and wind generators and organic gardening and, sustainable gardening that uses less water.
Right.
Any one of those things isn't exactly permaculture. What permaculture does is it takes those things and it links them. That's where the design, that's where the novel aspect of permaculture is its ability to form connections between those things.
I think that's really interesting. It definitely seems like permaculture is something that's going to be more important as we move into an age where sustainability becomes increasingly important. And you've talked about the amount of people who have gotten this design certificate. I'm wondering, what do you think the impact has been of permaculture on just people's thinking overall? I guess, what sort of impact has permaculture had on the way people are viewing design just as a culture?
Unfortunately, I don't think that it's had in terms of numbers of people. I think for the people who have come across it and have taken the time to study it and understand it and taken courses in it, I think it has a massive impact mm-hmm. on the way they look at the world and design. But due to the grassroots nature of permaculture and where it got its start on the fringes, it hasn't really been able to penetrate into that mainstream design discussion the way that it shouldn't have by this point. I mean, it's still a young discipline. It's only 30 years old.
Yeah.
But I would say that there is a lot of effort taking place, you know, particularly in a city like Vancouver, where there's actually a concerted effort by council and people involved to design things more smartly, mm-hmm. so that they function better, they're more sustainable, things like that. And I think that specialists need to actually be involved in those discussions and not say, well, we can do it better than all of you, but say, look, we understand how to connect things. We've studied this specific discipline, and we can help facilitate this process in a collaborative way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Would you say that permaculture, I know that the environment is becoming an increasingly big topic in the international sphere. Would you say that permaculture is a potential solution for our environmental problems?
Oh, absolutely. That's what brought me to it, is that, you know, I left university with a biology degree, which was just basically a dissertation on how bad things are. You know, just one course after another explaining just how badly we're mucking things up, and I didn't really feel I was provided with any kind of practical way forward to affect positive change in that realm. And it wasn't until I came across permaculture that I actually felt empowered to be able to begin as a career path and as a lifestyle and something that I was doing in my daily, like, working life to actually impact the environment in a positive way, to be involved in facilitating the change, designing the change.
Yeah. And do you think it's also because, I mean, do you think this idea is able to spread to different places? Because I know one of the issues in terms of environment is that there's certain countries that are still developing, and it's hard for them to develop sustainable ways of using resources, course. And they, like, would they be able to use permaculture, or is that still something that's only for North America, where we've already developed those institutions for?
No, I actually think that permaculture is probably most applicable in those places. Mm-hmm. I personally got my start working in the Dead Sea Valley of Jordan, in a place that is lagging behind in development like few others are, particularly with regards to water. I just taught a permaculture design course in Uganda last May, and I'm headed there again in November. And I mean, their power grid in Uganda, for people who have it, is like, it's standard, they're sub 1930s. Mm-hmm. So those people need the same level of access to technology that we do, and I think everybody knows that can't necessarily come about the same way that we've gotten there. And there's no reason why those people can't get to the same level of technical capability as we can without having to go down the same path. I think we can definitely help those regions of the world achieve the same opportunities that we experience here in the Western world, without a doubt.
That's really interesting, because I think that's a very, like, a big point.
Definitely. And I guess, Jesse, we know that Pacific Permaculture has the Alumni Convergence event coming up, and I guess that's for the public as well, correct? Like,
yes,
people can
absolutely
come and learn. Yeah. Yep. So can you just tell us a bit about what that is?
Yeah, so tomorrow in Vancouver at the Hive, which is on West Hastings, number 128 West Hastings, we're doing this thing we call the Alumni Convergence. But the only reason why we did that is because we've taught all these students and they're all off doing great things, and we've never actually gotten them together to share, you know, so that they could share their experiences. Mm-hmm. And so we've got a few pretty good speakers lined up, one talking about permaculture in the school system in Edmonton, another one talking about permaculture in northern Saskatchewan, another one talking about permaculture in Uganda. My wife is going to be talking about her experience with permaculture as a mother. And then we have open spaces in between where people can get together and talk about the things. So it's not just that typical, you know, chalk and talk. We're going to have mm-hmm. World Cafe-style open spaces on all kinds of sustainability topics, and it's totally open to the public. We're serving refreshments. There's no charge, and anybody who's interested in learning more about this subject, you're more than welcome to join us. It starts at 2:00 tomorrow and runs till 7:00. You can come for the whole time, or you can just stop in for an hour or so if you want, but it's going to be good.
Wow, that sounds awesome. Hopefully one of us will be able to make it down.
Yeah.
So thank you for taking the time to talk to us. We really learned a lot today.
Yeah, thank you. Great. Thank you so much.
All right,
thank you so much for having me.
Of course. Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.
So once again, that was Jesse Lemieux from Pacific Permaculture. If you're interested in learning more about the permaculture movement, you can always go to the alumni event, as he had mentioned. Once again, that's going to be tomorrow, Saturday, April 14th, starting at 2 p.m. until 7 p.m. at The Hive, which is 128 West Hastings Street. It's a free event. There will be food and refreshments and is open to the public.
That should be really interesting. I actually would love to go. That's interesting.
Yeah, sounds like a lot of fun. And that is our show for today, which is Friday, April 13th. Make sure to tune in next
Friday.
It's
the 13th.
It is Friday the 13th. But next Friday is going to be even more exciting because it's Friday, April 20th.
A.K.A. 420.
So we're going to be having a special program for you that day. All about 420, and if you don't know what 420 is, make sure you tune in on that day because then you can learn. So today's newscast was brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts. If you'd like to share your comments or get involved or give us an important news tip, please contact us through our email, news@citr.ca. You can subscribe to our podcast and listen to past shows and interviews on our website, citr.ca/news. For more independent news, join us on Monday and Friday at 5 p.m. for another edition of News 101. I'm Claire Eagle.
And I'm Nina Kurgia, and that's your show. Stay tuned for Stranded right here on CITR 101.5 FM. 29.